Welcome to Inclusive Career Conversations, the go-to podcast for HR leaders, talent acquisition specialists, and D&I champions. I'm your host, Zoe Hayden-Jones, and each episode, we'll dive deep with thought leaders and trailblazers, uncovering actionable insights that empower you to create a more inclusive environment for everyone. I'm so glad you're here. Let's do this. So before we jump into this week's episode, here are some things that you will learn from listening. So we're going to talk about accommodations in the workplace. Susie dives into the range of accommodations that she's received across different organizations. Some were very accommodating and supportive, others were less so. She also talks about the lack of sick pay when she had one particular role. We'll also talk about the importance of understanding and support. Susie found that being open about her disability led to better support and understanding, which ultimately improved her work experience and productivity. But she also talks about hiding it and feeling like she couldn't talk about it earlier on in her career. We're going to talk about inclusivity and how it benefits everyone. And if you are an employer, that you recognize the value that disabled employees bring to the workplace. We know that studies suggest that diverse teams make companies more money, especially diverse leadership, including those with disabilities, because we all learn to support each other effectively. We'll also cover addressing unconscious bias. So companies need to be upfront and aware of unconscious bias in the workplace. So whether they're investing in diversity and inclusion training, this will help to create a more supportive and inclusive work environment for all. Susie talks about being ghosted, a very, very final stage of an interview process, which was really quite shocking. And then finally, we talk about normalizing accommodation discussions. So access needs, regardless of disability status, and how we can create a more inclusive workplace culture by making everything normal to talk about. So asking about access needs should become standard practice, right? When setting up meetings or events or interviews. And we are seeing movement on this, but we need to see more of it. So it's a fantastic episode. I'd love to know what you think. Don't forget to get in touch if you've got any feedback on this episode, and enjoy.
I am so excited to welcome my guest this week. We have Susie Bold, who is a director of marketing in the film industry. So welcome to the podcast, Susie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm particularly excited because we go way back, don't we, babes?
We do.
So tell everybody we met. Oh God, I'm not even going to get into years because it's boring for everyone to listen to.
It was over 10 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. How fast has that gone? So Susie and I met at an agency, a film agency, and it was at a time in my life where I'd just come back from traveling and I wasn't feeling anything work related. I wasn't feeling where I worked. It was just not a good time. And Susie was like the light in the darkness at work. So I like to laugh a lot, and you basically made me laugh every single day. And we've obviously kept in touch. So talk to me about, that was 10 years ago. So talk to us about what you're doing now, and just a little intro. Talk to us about you.
Okay. So before I worked with you, I worked for another agency in Bristol, and there's a very long story about my trajectory in work, but also kind of the intersection of what I think we want to talk about, which is the fact that I am disabled, I've got an invisible disability. So I'll talk a little bit about how that came about and then my journey into work, because it actually happened before I got sort of a proper professional grown-up job. So I went to uni in Bristol, I graduated with a first, and I was literally like, the world is my oyster. What am I going to do? And then over the last year of uni, I had been getting really bad back pain, and I'd had it just came out of nowhere, and it was extremely bad pain, and like it would wake me up at night, and I kept going to the doctors. I went to A&E. I once like collapsed in the gym and went to A&E, and I was just getting nowhere. So they would just say, oh, you're stressed, it's anxiety. Like they were kind of trying to fob me off. When I collapsed in the gym and I went to A&E, the guy there said, you just need to have more confidence when you're walking. Because he wanted to discharge me. He was like, there's nothing wrong with you. He didn't do an MRI, didn't do any tests. He just said, oh no, there's nothing wrong, you're fine. And I was like, well, I keep collapsing, like what can I do about it? And he said, well, you just need to have more confidence when you're walking. And I was like, oh, thanks mate. With that glowing piece of medical advice, I will crack on. Anyway, this went on for about 9 months, and eventually I was just like, this car, I need, it was getting worse and worse. And I couldn't wee. Like I woke up one morning, I just couldn't wee. Like I was losing motor skills, but I didn't know what was going on. And I went to A&E. I went to my doctor and she said, you need to go to hospital this afternoon. And she got me in and I was had an MRI scan the next day. And then they told me, you've got a tumor on your spinal cord and it's emergency. You have to go and have an operation tomorrow. So I literally found out and 2 days later was operated on. And when I woke up, they thought it would be easy and I'd be there for like a week, and I woke up paralyzed. I was like, this is not going to plan. This is bad. And they didn't know what was going to happen to me. So they kind of just said, we're going to have to wait and see. You know, you may never walk again. We just don't really know what's going on here. And gradually over time, I learned how to walk again, but I was left with chronic pain, with kind of weakness in my legs, especially my left leg. So I could only walk short distances. I couldn't stand up for long periods of time. And I have now in this sort of similar situation where I have a, I guess, like mobility disability. And I had to go from that to figuring out how to live my whole life, because I'd not had a job. I wasn't in a relationship. It was in that such a formative time. I was like 22, 23, where you're building your identity. And I was just like, holy shit, what am I going to do? So I went and worked in a call center just because I had to get some money. And it was so bad that I had to go to the toilet lunch and just lie on the floor because I was in so much pain. And I had tried to get benefits, but because I'd never paid national insurance, they were like, no, we can't give you any money. So, and you can't, you're only disabled, like legally, if you've had it for over 6 months. And I'd only had it at this point for like 3 months. So I was just like, I'm going to have to get a job. So I went and worked in call center. And then I was reading this magazine called Venue Magazine that was like, you know, cool places to go in Bristol. And I saw this ad saying, do you like film? Do you like music? Do you want to come and work for this startup agency? And I was like, yeah. So I went to the interview on crutches and they were like, oh, what's happened to you? And I was like, well, I had a tumor. It's like a long story. And but I just really got on with the guy I was interviewing and he gave me the job. And I started on £12,000 in like 2007.
Oh my gosh, Susie, I've got like a million questions. My first of all, I just have to point out, because I think everyone listening is going to be like shouting at the if they're watching on YouTube or whatever, but being fobbed off, you need to be more confident with your walking. That is a disgrace, and I know a lot of people get fobbed off. How did it feel when you woke up and the news was broken to you that you might never walk again? I mean, this is huge.
I know. It's so strange because actually at that time I was on so much morphine and I was on so much drugs that I didn't have this like big realization moment. It was more like a slow realization over like a few weeks of like, oh, this is big, like this is life changing. And yeah, it was a really dark time. I was so lucky because I had this physio called Lizzie who was about 30. And I'm still in touch with her. And she was exactly who I needed at that time. And she just believed in me. And we worked together. And she gave me a lot of her own time to help me like learn how to walk again, basically. But it was wild. It's so surreal to be so far past it now, because I look back and I can't quite believe that I went through it. It seems really bizarre, but it also has shaped my whole life in good ways and bad ways. You know, it's like anything. It has bought me a lot. I think it makes me, ironically, much better at work now that I'm older and I understand it more and I've got past the trauma of it. It helps me keep a level head and a perspective that I don't think I'd have otherwise.
I love that. That is, it almost brings you back down to earth because you pretty much, you could have lost your life. So obviously, it wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, it wasn't malignant then, the tumor.
No.
And how quickly were you laying on that call center floor to make some money after that?
Went into hospital in August and I got a job in December.
Wow.
I know. I can't quite believe. I actually regret that a bit. I wish I had probably not. I think I wish I'd gone home to my parents, but I'm such a independent, like very stubborn person that I was like, no, I want to go and live my life. And they were like, well, okay. So
you were still in Bristol.
Yeah, I stayed in Bristol. I lived on my friend's, it was so stupid when I lived retrospectively, I made some errors, but she had a mattress on the floor and we slept together in her mattress on the floor. And then she went traveling and I stayed there for a bit. And then I moved in and got a proper place to live. But yeah, I was just very stubborn, I think. And yeah, it was just a very strange experience. And then when I went to work in the first agency, I didn't even know it was publicity. This is where you and I started. I didn't even know what it was. I started actually with a book and they were like, we need you to get 20 news items about this book. And I was like, what? How do I do that? And I had to go and say to the girl next to me, like, what are we doing? What is this? And she was amazing. She told me what to do. And then one of the first ever films I worked on was The Dark Knight. And me and Teague, you know, our lovely friend Teague, we worked together on it. And that was the first ever Facebook film fan page for a film.
Oh, wow.
What a history.
That is incredible. That is incredible. One of my first films at Warner Brothers, I think, was a Batman film, but it's escaped me which one. There's a few things I just need to pick out here. First is that you rocked up on crutches and
to a
job where you didn't even know what publicity was, PR was, and you got the job. Massive tip. And that guy that interviewed you believed in you. He saw that spark that we would see in you. And how long did you stay there then?
I stayed there for 2 years. And actually, after I was there for 9 months, so when I had the tumor, when I had the first operation, because it lasted for 9 hours, they didn't manage to remove the whole tumor because they were worried about me being under it for that long and they didn't know what my function level would be. So they closed me up and I had to go and have another operation. And so I was about 10 months into this job and I had to go and tell them I needed to have another operation. And there's a kind of weird story about that. But I remember the managing director saying, you've not been here very long. You better make sure you're indispensable in the next few months so we don't get rid of you.
Oh,
and I was like, wow, okay. Oh. It was quite scary. And then I ended up being...
Sorry to interrupt. How did that make you feel when he said that? Do you remember?
I think I felt a mixture of nervous and pissed off, which actually is a signature of me of my whole career, probably. Just a mixture of nervous and annoyed. I think... I don't know. I think at that point, I was early on in being disabled and all of the societal messaging about how it makes you worthless hadn't penetrated my psyche. So I had my non-disabled, able-bodied mentality of probably a level of like entitlement to respect. And I think that is chipped away at when you experience life as a marginalized person. And my experience is obviously being white and, you know, educationally privileged and socially and economically privileged and having grown up in a really privileged upbringing, but then also experiencing what it's like to have a level of exclusion from society, have judgments from society. When I was on crutches, I got a lot of verbal abuse on the street. And when I was in a wheelchair for a bit, I got a lot of verbal abuse. People yelling like, fucking cripple. Sorry, can I swear? I don't. Like, people would be savage. Like, and I was still on crutches for a while and I used to sing at that point. I did an open mic night. And I remember getting on stage and I was just about to sing. I think it was the first or second time that I had sung again since it happened. And someone like yelling some, I can't remember what it was, but something about my crutches, about how, I think it was something about being a cripple or a retard. Obviously those words are both unacceptable, but it really was so eye-opening because I'd gone through life in this bubble of privilege essentially. And then it sort of burst and it was like, oh, okay, now I get to see different parts of what it's like to live in this country if you aren't insulated by all forms of privilege.
That is so interesting, Susie, when you look at it from that respect, that you've seen both sides of the coin, which is horrific. Those experiences are just horrific. But what is eye-opening for a lot of people listening is that there's people going through that daily
and they're
by that. So what I want to just go back to then is right at the beginning of the podcast, you use the term invisible disability. When you were able to walk without the crutches, did you notice a difference?
So the main challenge I found initially was I felt a lot of shame about it and I really wanted to hide the fact that I was disabled, and that made my life quite difficult, particularly at work, because there was stuff I knew I couldn't do, but I didn't feel confident to talk to my boss about it or to talk to the people, my colleagues. And I remember it being really tough when I first moved to where we worked together, because we were expected to like sometimes cover red carpets or cover, you know, junkets or sign in screenings. And I'd always have so much worry in the back of my mind of like, will there be someone to sit down? Will I be able to tell people I need to sit down? What will happen if I was really anxious for a long time about collapsing, which had never happened to me, but it was like a really strong fear. And I was still really young and inexperienced, and I felt I hadn't earned, I guess, the right to have some access needs. And I didn't even understand that they were access needs and that everybody has access needs, but we don't really talk about them unless they're for disabled people. So we're both wearing glasses, and really that's an access need. Like, without them, we couldn't see properly. And like, that's become totally normalized. You wouldn't feel weird about it. You don't feel ashamed about it, but you probably would if you suddenly had to use the mobility scooter or a crutch or a walking stick or a rollator or a different access device. And we have created as a society a really strange set of rules about what's allowed and what's not allowed. Like, some people are really sniffy and weird with you if you have dietary restrictions or like, and that's just so that you can access food without it making you sick. Like, there's all this stuff, and I hadn't learned any of it. Took me so long into being disabled to learn all that information that at the start I just felt shame, and I just felt like I didn't want people to know, and I didn't want people to judge me, and I was worried I wouldn't get employed. I was scared to mention it in interviews. Like, it felt like this big elephant in the room to me.
How did that make you feel?
I think it did destroy my self-esteem. I felt very worthless for a long time.
I'm not surprised.
It was horrible. And also, you know, the environments that we worked in, they weren't that compassionate and sort of kind, nurturing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the expectation. I was chatting to someone earlier about my experiences when I got pregnant, and I won't go into that in detail now, but the treatment before of the assumptions that you wouldn't have a baby at your age kind of thing that was said, but not, yeah. Oh, cool. Which I'm going to do a whole podcast on. And I remember, you know, that's a whole other conversation, but yeah. It's kind of like, I can relate to you in the environment. Yeah. Not nurturing. And In that first job, when you said you needed surgery again, were they accommodating, or did you have the mask on? Were you like, okay.
They were actually practically accommodating. So obviously the MD made that comment of like, oh, you better prove your worth. But I was off for a month. They paid me in full. They didn't even talk to me about not paying me. They just paid me in full. And they let me come back on like reduced hours. So like I came back for half days first. I can't remember exactly, but I came back a few days a week or whatever. And that was amazing. And actually, when I then went on to the next job where you and I worked together, I randomly had this thing where I woke up one morning and I'd lost feeling, I'd lost sensation, and I had to go to hospital. And I was there for 2 weeks because they thought I had another tumor, and the waiting list for an MRI was long. They couldn't get me in immediately, but they couldn't let me go because they thought I had another tumor. And I remember telling work, and they were initially so lovely. They're like, don't worry. They sent me flowers. They were like really lovely. And then when I did go back to work, and I'd basically had like a trapped nerve, and that was the problem. And it had had an impact on my mobility and walking. So I was going back on slightly reduced hours. And I went in and they said, by the way, we don't actually cover sick pay here. So that I had to pay back pay. And then they were like, and they wouldn't cover. There was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but they were quite unaccommodating about it. And I felt like I'd done something wrong. So it's through my career, it's only the business I work for now that I feel has got it. Like they understand, they're very happy to make reasonable adjustments for me. Like I work from home more than my colleagues, but we all have a hybrid setup. And that's been life-changing for me, especially in managing my pain. But up until that point, my experiences with HR in general have been pretty disappointing. I had one thing, you know, there's like company away days where you're going to like bond with your colleagues. I had one instance where they wanted us to do an assault course, and I was like, I absolutely can't do that. I cannot do that. And they wouldn't believe me. I had to get my surgeon to write them a letter that was like, these are all the reasons why she can't do it. And actually it could make her disability worse. Like, don't make her do it. And the HR manager had this meeting and it was so humiliating. And she said something like, I've got a bad back. I could say I'm disabled. Like, it hurts. And I was like, I can't feel my legs properly. Like, I've had a laminectomy. I'm missing part of my vertebrae. Like, I've had two very extensive surgery. I have permanent nerve damage. Not to undermine what she had, but it just felt so awful. And then she said, well, why don't you come and sit on the sidelines? And I said, I think I might be feeling a bit uncomfortable, and like, you know, it just made me feel bad. And she said, I've got friends in wheelchairs and they'd happily come and sit on the sidelines. I was like, okay, great, that's great, thanks. It was so humiliating, and it was a masterclass in how not to do it. I think
100% I hope she has left that place, and I hope she's been
she's more successful than ever, Zoe.
Oh my, that is the fundamental issue. It's, and when we're looking at disabilities at work, it's that assumption. She read into your situation and thought that her bad back was a comparative. But regardless of what you've been through, if you as an employee didn't want to partake in an assault course in a work environment, that is your decision. That's what I find so, like, apart from everything that you've been through, for her just to undermine and just make you feel so little is disgraceful.
was awful. A horrible, horrible experience.
So then when the place you're at now, have you got any examples of how, I know you've talked about the hybrid working, but what about when we look back at you, Susie, in the early career that had that shame, how has maybe how they've accommodated to you and how you've grown, how is that, what's it like for you now at work?
I'm very open about the fact I'm disabled. I talk about it regularly. I self-identify as disabled and I feel like no sense of shame about it. And actually, there's so many reasons why I think being disabled has made me a better employee, and it's made me a better boss. In terms of like the identity, obviously I work in marketing now and 1 in 5 people are disabled. Like it's a huge portion of consumers, and just having an understanding of that, even though I don't have a nuanced understanding of all disability, I understand the concept of making things accessible and inclusive and, you know, what it actually means to have a meaningful impact in that segment and not just talk the talk, but actually make the changes yourself. Like that's something that I think benefits us holistically as a business, because there's money to be made on a really like fundamental level. But there's studies about how businesses that hire disabled people are more productive, because in a team, if you work with people with different disabilities and different needs and different capabilities, you actually work better together because you are figuring out how best to support each other. And I think I have a really strong focus on, I guess, nurturing people's strengths in the team. I think it makes me much more empathetic and understanding. I have so much perspective and I'm able to multitask in a way that I find really easy, because you prioritize so much as a disabled person. If you have limited energy or limited capacity, you're always thinking, how can I do this in the way that is the easiest, the quickest, that uses the least amount of energy, that's the most efficient. And that is so transferable into a workplace, because that's what we're all trying to do all the time. Like, how can I drive efficiency in this space? And as a disabled person, it's like built into my DNA now. Like, that's how I look at my entire life. So there's just so many ways that I think it kind of works. And I think partly it's a better place to work for me now because I am more confident and more open. I'm more senior, so I automatically have more sway. I think that just comes with the territory. But also times have changed as well. Like when we started, it was 16 years ago, so long ago. And I think bigger movements, like we have become more socially and culturally aware of marginalized communities over the last 16 years. And like Me Too and kind of everything that happened with Black Lives Matter, like these movements help, I think, move forward everyone who experiences marginalization. And there's holistic benefits to us just as humankind, I think, but they also particularly help people who experience different forms of marginalization. So, sorry, that was a really rambly answer.
No, I loved that. I loved it when you talked about efficiency as well, because it's like a no-brainer. Every organization wants to be efficient, but I can understand when you talk about that energy, using up energy. Like I'm a yoga teacher, but I often think about like the energy expenditure for different tasks. So I can really relate to that. And that makes you a brilliant employee. But I just think you're such a great person anyway, but to have you at the top and have a team where you have that extra level of understanding is brilliant. And I think more organizations need that. And the more organizations bring people with different requirements, disabilities, different backgrounds, different genders, the better it's going to be to work in tandem and to get the best out of it. And especially when you work in marketing, understanding the needs of people that are buying your product or wherever you work.
Yeah, 100%.
It's so powerful. I spoke to someone in the NHS recently about doing some work because they've got like a women's network and they've got a disability group. And when I got on the phone, he was like, please think about putting content out about being a disabled person, looking for jobs, first of all, what the hell does the job ad say? Is it going to be suitable to someone with a disability, whether that's you know, whatever that is, or and what's the application process like? And yes. I've spoken to other companies that will, if someone is honest on the application, maybe that application gets pushed out of the way and they somehow lose it. Because let's face it, there are companies that are still doing that.
This is my moment to share this story that I've been seeing on for years. I interviewed at Netflix about six years ago, and firstly, I had something like 15 interviews, like it went on, and I had one session that was, I want to say, 6 or 7 back-to-back interviews. And I did, which is horrifying when you think about it. And I did it. I remember I was so exhausted by the time I got home that I just ordered a takeaway and I went to bed at 8 and I was literally like shaking. I felt like I had so much adrenaline and I was just like, ugh. And I thought subsequently, I was like, that was so inaccessible actually, because only someone, it prevents anyone that has any kind of like, sorry, it's windy outside and something just fell over. It just is, it's inaccessible to anyone with any kind of access need. For that reason, I thought that. And then during the process of the interview, I think it was the last interview, and I'd gone through all of it, and all the feedback every time had been really, really positive. And I got to the last one, and I thought, and I hadn't mentioned my disability. And I was like, I want to mention it because I want to be transparent. And I said, I just want to make you aware that I'm disabled and I don't think it's going to have a massive impact on the job, but it would affect me if I was traveling. I'd need like an extra day either side so that I could decompress and rest and my body could kind of recalibrate. And then I didn't hear from them. They ghosted me. And I chased them on email to be like, what's going on? Because you have a recruitment person throughout the whole process and they give you feedback. They're like, they love you. And this final interview was with the first person I'd seen again. So it was like, they're like, this is the final flourish. And I just didn't hear from them. And I chased them on email. Eventually I got this really wishy-washy email that said something like, we didn't think you were creative enough. And I went back, called them out, and I said, because you know they have an ethos of transparency. And I said, embracing your ethos of transparency, I think unconscious bias has been at play here, because I had very strong feedback throughout the whole process. And I mentioned my disability in the final round with someone I'd already met, and suddenly a yes turned into a no. And they obviously freaked out. They sent me this really long email. It's like, no, it's nothing to do with that. It's actually been something that they've talked about throughout the whole process. And I was like, well, I'm not going to believe you now. And I think the thing about unconscious bias is it's unconscious. You haven't acknowledged that and absorbed that yourself. So you might well believe that you don't think I'm creative enough. And this is something you believe the entire time. But my experience is this dynamic changed when I told you I was disabled.
Oh, I'm actually speechless. I'm speechless, but I'm not surprised, if you know what I mean. Yeah. I'm sorry that you went through that. It doesn't surprise me. It upsets me so much. And well done for being transparent. I'm a firm believer that the universe, you know, you were meant to get the job that you're in now, and you were not meant to work for an organization that, you know, was going to not support you in your needs. And also, can we just cut to the, like, you are really creative, so screw them.
I know. Pick something that I feel like anyone I've worked with would say that I'm really creative. So it's like, you could have picked so many things that are things that I'm not good at. what I'm confident in.
It's really sad though to anyone listening, because my next question was going to be like advice for someone that is living with a disability that maybe wants to go for a job. Let's face it, organizations would welcome you to be transparent and there wouldn't be any unconscious bias. But let's face it, there are lots of companies like what we just talked about. So what advice would you give to someone if someone's listening and they're like, I need to be more transparent with work, or should I just keep it in? You've lived and breathed it. What advice would you give them?
So I've gone through incidents where I've told people at interview stage and I haven't. And I think I've got jobs when I've told people and I obviously haven't. I didn't tell my current company, mainly because in many ways it doesn't affect, if there was traveling or a lot of physical aspects of the job that it would affect me. So I think it's really a judgment call on whether you feel it's going to have an impact on your day to day in a big way. And I think if it does, then it is fair to say, these are my access needs, and these are all the reasons why I'm going to make sure it works anyway. I have different needs, but it doesn't mean that I'm not worth employing. And you can highlight all the reasons why. I think it's useful to have insight, if you're going to be talking about it, about the fact that there are studies about including disabled people at work and that actually improving the overall productivity, and what you bring to the table just by having a different perspective. It's tricky. It's a really hard one to navigate. I don't think we're 100%, we're probably not even 50% there yet in terms of really embracing disabled people in the workplace. I think we still have a really long way to go. And there's a broad spectrum of disability and needs. So we have a really long way to go.
What do you think companies need to be doing to be more inclusive?
I think they need to first recognize that there's a huge amount of value in disabled employees, because I think there's probably, it's probably worry or like the misconception that they'll be hard to manage, or it will be really difficult, it will be expensive. Like, and that's just kind of not, firstly, it's not true often. And secondly, I've seen businesses invest in able-bodied, terrible, terrible employees on a very regular basis. So I think there's confronting that. I do think that things will change as more, because I think the younger generations, not always, are naturally more inclusive as culture is changing. And I think as they grow into more leadership roles, things will change. I think just being open to not letting your perceived ideals get the better of you, and addressing your unconscious bias. I think that's a really important part of it as well. You can do unconscious bias training now. You can do like training courses online for free.
Yes, it is fascinating as well. And going back to that process, I know we've got to wrap up soon. Did that organization ask you anything? You know, when you went through that, when you went home and had the takeaway, eight hours, did they ask you any questions about your needs before this grueling interview day of back-to-back interviews?
No.
It's such a simple question. It's the same as like, can you eat nuts, or what are your dietary requirements?
And
it's like starting with the basics that frustrates me so much.
Yeah, same.
And then your experience is so negative.
I know. It's such a shame, isn't it? I think what I did a panel quite recently about inclusion in the workplace, and they asked like, what's the number one thing that you want to kind of normalize? And I think it's asking everyone, when you're setting up something for someone new, or you're setting up a meeting, etc., if you just ask, do you have any access needs? Even if you know they're disabled or non-disabled, all that kind of stuff, I think the more we say it, the more that it will actually just become part of normal, because we need to kind of normalize the fact that disabled people are going to come into work sometimes and like they might have a need, and everyone does, like, but yeah, I think that would be really helpful just for the community, for us to engage more in the workplace. And also, I obviously don't speak for all disabled people. It's just my own experience, and lots of other people would have different views, I guess, but
Yeah, we should maybe do a panel. We should look at doing a panel with people with all different disabilities. That would be so fascinating to understand, you know, like those nuggets of information that you've shared, your experiences, and how we can start to make a change at this grassroots approach. It's like you and I have this chat, and then hundreds of people listen, and then, you know, like how can we start to make this change? And we have to do it by using our voice. I could talk to you about this and loads of other things. But we have to wrap up. What does the future hold for you when you're thinking about work? And obviously it's great that you have almost come into your power in the way you're being so open about your life and your experience, which I think you don't realize that you're helping so many other people. What's the future looking like for you?
Down to her neurodiverse.
It's a good question. I really like what I'm doing at the moment.
We need to get that message out there more. And like I said at the beginning, there are so many women
leading a team of 10,
message me.
And it's just so, I just love working with them all. Like, there's loads of people who are in their 20s,
whatever position you're in, whether you're managing a team
about the future, whether you are. They're just so bright and engaging, and
they have really impressive getting a diagnosis. I hope that this podcast has opened your eyes a little bit and made you think in about the
relationship towards work, which I think look back at some of the hours that we used to do, and I'm like,
it's okay to disclose it.
I gave up my 20s to like sign in screenings.
If you're managing teams, maybe you can think about your approach.
But I really love what I'm seeing, and I
because I think Cheryl just touched on
I think when you're a manager.
Really
you
important
have a huge
point about people
influence
management,
on
the
that
human approach,
day-to-day life, and their experience of life when they're
so
working
I think
in
a lot
that
we
business.
Can learn from this
and
episode,
I take that
so
responsibility
really, hope you
really
enjoyed.
Seriously.
If you haven't
and
already,
I want
please join the members club. It's totally free.
I want to find ways
free,
to give
masterclasses every month,
opportunities,
free training,
and
it's
see
all
them grow and
sitting
learn
in the members area.
Have
so
new
all
skills,
the new
whilst also obviously like helping
on a weekly basis. We've got free yoga, mindfulness, meditation. Head to the show notes
I'm
now
very lucky
or
that
head
where I work
to community.jobsforwomen.co.uk/join. And I will
and
see you next week.
So
take
yeah,
care
I just,
of yourself.
I'm just really enjoying it. I just feel good.
I think it's so amazing what you just said then about that tiny little nugget of having such an influence on people's day to day. Because let's face it, we spend a lot of time at work. And I bet you are, I know you are an incredible manager in making sure that they are developing, growing, and they're happy and okay.
Yes.
It's so funny when you talk about the hours we used to work. I was chatting to someone the other day and I was saying about I'm a yoga teacher. And I remember at one of my last jobs before we left to move back to Leeds, I used to go to the hour class and then I used to get back to my desk a bit late. Bear in mind, I'd been like emails all night, evening, weekend events. You know, every hour that wasn't documented, and I started getting the eye as I'd come back to my desk.
Yeah,
stopping that yoga class, and if I could go back to my 20-odd-year-old self, I'd be like, Zoe, go to that yoga class, book it every single lunchtime because you're doing about 20 hours overtime a week. And I loved what you said about the boundaries because I'd love that the next generation is so in tune with that is not in my contract. I don't do
that. Yeah, and when you think about it, you're like, yeah, fair enough. Like what? Why do I feel sometimes I have to confront my own sort of programming because we always used to work so much overtime, because we used to give so much for nothing. I do think there's like this deep, like seeded expectation where I'm like, well, I did it. And then I'm like, no, Susie, no, absolutely not. Like it was wrong then. And now I have an opportunity to right that wrong. Like I feel really lucky.
Amazing. More of that, please, because you're just basically influencing people's lives and the next generation. So if people want to connect with you, which I'm sure they will, where is the best place to find you?
I'm on LinkedIn, the best and most exciting social platform. Susie, will you put my name in it, in the thing? It's Susie Bold. So I will put it because it's a weird spelling.
Okay, yeah, I'll pop that in. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's do that panel. Let's do more.
Yeah,
let's
love to
keep the conversation going. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's so nice to see you.
I really hope you enjoyed this week's episode with Susie. She is such a breath of fresh air and has such insight into what it is truly like to live and work with an invisible disability. Some real shocking moments, eye-opening moments, but by Susie sharing her story and her experiences, it can only create this conversation to create change that needs to happen. We need to see this ripple effect. So if you want to reach out, if you've got any feedback on the episode, if you want to join me and be a guest on the episode, I'd love to hear from you. Email hello@jobsforwomen.co.uk. And I have a special favor to ask if you've got this far. It is so important for us to reach more people with the incredible work that we're doing at Inclusive Career Conversations. One review is the equivalent to 1,000 downloads. Can you take a moment right now to drop onto your favorite podcast player and leave us a review? It would mean the world to the team and I. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time.